All right, at this time we have a report and possible discussion on Possum Kingdom Shoreline Management Plan and Customer Guide presented by Kent Rendy, Upper Basin Regional Manager.
I'll let my cohorts get in position. Again, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
There's a monitor in the room next to the people up here who can't see this. Because of the projector, I just think we shouldn't get everybody over there. So you can't see next door, there's a monitor, and you should be able to see both of them.
If I could, for those that are here, certainly visitors that may not know me or Laura Lee or Mike, I'm Kent Rendy, the Upper Basin Regional Manager. Possum Kingdom is within my area of responsibility. Laura Lee Ballin is our general counsel here on staff. And Mike Deltas, as most all of you know, I think, is our project manager at PK and as well at Granberry. I think probably the first thing that I would say in regards to Mr. Upham's comments as well is as we work through this issue, there was never an attempt at all in the detail that we tried to put within this rule book to be heavy-handed with anyone, nor will it ever be that attempt. You, the board, asked us to prepare a rule book, I think specifically because it got to a point where numerous issues that Mike was working at PK ended up being brought to the board for decision. The guidance was not clear as far as the community at PK was concerned, as far as the expectations of the authority. So the board asked us, the staff, to task us to prepare guidelines, both residential and commercial, to where everybody was on the same sheet of music with the rules, and that's what we tried to do. I can tell you there's a tremendous amount of staff time that went into this. Mike Eltis and his folks probably spent a good course of almost 2 years prior to the official tasking, but trying to get us a draft to which we could work. Numerous all-day sessions with about 15 folks, to include our project manager and Lake Ranger from Limestone and assistant project manager at Granberry. Where we worked all day sessions not only to finalize the draft as best we could, but then to go over all of the inputs that you, the community, provided to us on that as well. So it's been a very labor-intensive issue, but certainly one that we did in good faith and feel very good about the end product, I think, that we had to at least show and discuss. Many of you in the public asked that we extend the input time frame for that, and Director Gear did that back in December to allow for comments through the middle of February. We certainly appreciate everyone that took the time to do that, even though it looked like, from a lessee standpoint, there was a fairly small percentage of lessees that contributed. Those that did, there was about 250-plus comments that we received, and we really do appreciate the input for that, because there were some positive changes that we made to that as well that I'll just briefly cover on a couple areas here. Those that we felt like were relevant, certainly such as permit issues, and Mr. Upham touched on that as well, a concern for routine maintenance and partial repairs. We provided language that allowed for such maintenance and repair, so it didn't appear like anything that you wanted to do, whether it be change a light bulb, fix a partial roof, or whatever, had to go through a long, extensive permit process to even do that. Grandfathering. Numerous comments on grandfathering. We changed the language within the guide that addressed pre-existing issues, such as structures and on-water facilities, and they also addressed pre-existing structures in the FERC project area. The $1,000 post-construction permit fee was another real issue with you folks that you felt like certainly was more of a fine, as I recall some of the comments being, than a fee itself. We removed the $1,000 post-construction permit fee and modified language for improvements that were completed without construction permit, because that was the issue of this fee that was out there, was those that did not take the time to do due diligence with Mike and his folks when they did construction and that, and then came back after the fact asking for forgiveness on that. And what we basically said was that those that do something without getting a construction permit, that lessee would be responsible for the associated cost to ensure the compliance thereafter and after the fact. There are some things that the staff respectfully agreed to disagree with on the comments, and I'd just like to touch on two or three of those. Unencapsulated foam. There was a real concern there from especially the commercial entities, but also with the residential. And we looked at various things, certainly none the least, the FERC license, where we are charged with extending the feasible and desirable to protect and enhance the project's scenic, recreational, and other environmental values. And that probably last portion of that was the biggest charge that we saw on our plate with unencapsulated foam. In the effects area, we had concern for wildlife, for fish, for trashing around the lake that happens with that unencapsulated foam, structural flotation problems. The staff believes that the 2015 time frame for replacement is a fair time frame. Committee and the board may feel differently. The residents and some of the commercial folks felt like, number one, that was probably too soon, and number two, it wasn't necessary at all. We recommended within the guide, I believe it was, a reduction in an annual on-water facility permit for the commercial entities of about 10% to enhance them to get that done prior to. It may be that the board wants to consider something much more advantageous to them on that. We're certainly open to do that. But we were concerned about unencapsulated foam, and we still firmly believe that that needs to be replaced on the lake. Code enforcement. Staff recommends code enforcement for various reasons. Again, the FERC license. Licensees shall also ensure that the use and occupancies for which it grants permission are maintained in good repair and comply with applicable state and local health and safety requirements. That's a mandate from the license. We provided two options to the lessee: hire a licensed professional on their own, or use a contracted inspector of the BRA if they decide to do the work themselves. It does not affect grandfather areas unless construction permit is required, and to us provides a value to improvement and assurance to potential buyers that things are in accordance with code. One other issue was, I guess it was kind of an irritant as much as anything to the folks out there, was the language that we used at the sole discretion of the authority. I think some folks felt like that was dictatorial. We didn't need to put that in there that way. We heard those comments and we understood it. But quite frankly, we never meant it to be offensive, nor do we feel that it should be viewed as such. In every case, however, we deemed the language necessary and prudent as legal terminology to effectively manage the authority's asset. And we felt very strongly that any deeded property owner sitting around the lake that had someone do something to their property would probably want to be in their sole discretion to remediate that. And again, we never meant that language to be offensive to anyone, but we felt like on a legal basis in that, that we needed to leave that in there, and we left it in there as it is. All in all, we believe the guides, both residential and commercial, are a tremendous first for the lake, for its residents, and certainly for the authority. It puts everyone on the same sheet of music, and hopefully will serve as a living guide for all to follow. In the words of one lessee in the comments that we received, all in all, the guide is great and has been needed for a long time. We may have gotten more than we wanted, but like it or not, we can no longer complain that we only found out about it after the BRA caught us. Thanks for allowing us input. Now, each of the board members have had time to review the draft documents as well as the inputs in that over the past couple weeks. Normally, Mike and I are prepared to cover each and every input if you'd like to do that, or if there's specific issues that you'd like to discuss, we'll do that. The way we organize it here is all of the comments, if you want to bring that up, I think Jennifer's probably doing that tonight. We didn't change one comment that was provided to us. If there were typos in those comments, we left them in there. That wasn't a concern of ours at all. They're verbatim. They are listed on the front screen. The red highlight is what we as staff felt like was integral to an issue that we were working within the document. The items that are left in black in many cases were emotional type issues and people just, in my words, wanted to vent a little bit with us. Or there were other areas that may have not even been applicable to the GAG, to the voting capacity study or whatever. But the red highlighted areas are the ones that we felt like we needed to address and look at, and we did that. And then the staff's comments follow that. On the left-hand side, we've got the customer guide, both residential and commercial, that we'll bring out depending if we need to reference those for a little bit more expediency for the board in that. So, sir, gentlemen, I'll open it to the board for any comments or concerns. And ladies?
I'd sort of like a bit of a briefing on the permit process, just so everyone here understands. I mean, I'm not sure if I completely understand the ins and outs and the complete details, so I'd like to hear some of that.
That's a pretty broad subject. Permits span both on water and on land activities. On land activities, as far as our particular holdings are concerned, our permitting responsibilities on water are all-encompassing. Anything that's on the lake, FERC license gives us the authority to permit and make sure that in the process of doing so, that the things that are placed on that water and are constructed appropriately and safely and meet the best needs of the water in terms of aesthetics, in terms of construction, and in terms of recreation for the public. Generally speaking, and I'll answer any specific questions you might have, but generally speaking, a permit's required for any new construction or a significant, and I'm talking about on-land facilities right now, for any new construction or for any major repairs that are done to a facility, on-land facility. Now, like Kent mentioned, we listened to the comments coming back, and Mr. Ruppam's comments are certainly well taken, and we did modify language in there with an attempt to identify to the leaseholder their ability to do minor construction repairs and those kinds of things associated with normal home ownership without benefit of a permit. They just go out and do it. It always becomes, permitting always becomes a little bit of a gray area when you kind of move from the aspect of minor repair into minor modification. And in terms of modifying the facilities and making that leap, we think the smartest thing for folks to do is they got a question, come down and ask, and we'll give them an honest answer. It's not our intention to require excess permits from what is required. I mean, bottom line is it's a lot of work for the office staff up there to be able to schedule those permits and inspections, go out and do that activity. In terms of on-water facilities, it's very much the same. We, again, modify the language in this from the original that was put online to allow for some minor repairs to on-water facilities, replacement of deck boards and those kinds of things that would be routine maintenance. Certainly don't require a permit from the authority. But when you get into the business of adding a lift or adding a personal watercraft ramp, those type of things that would expand the footprint, then it's appropriate that a permit would be required. And again, that bridges into our FERC license. So I hope I've given you the information that you want. Any specifics, either myself or I've got staff here that can help you.
In regards to off-water facilities, specifically people's homes, kind of what's the dividing line between permit and no permit? Is it a dollar amount? Is it?
No, it is. It is if it could be considered routine maintenance to a structure, then you wouldn't be required to do it. And we give some examples in the guide. We've changed these words now, so the stuff that the public might have read online, they've responded to and we've changed. But it's routine maintenance. If you were changing windows, you had a broken window, you had shingles that fell off the roof, those kind of routine maintenance activities would not require a permit. However, if you're adding a deck or you're going to add a walkout on top of your roof, those type of activities would require a permit.
Well, so say, for instance, somebody receives hail damage. Their insurance covers a complete replacement for the roof. Does that require a permit?
If the entire roof had to be replaced, yeah, a permit would be required.
Okay.
But not a partial?
Let me clarify this just a little bit. We've had storms up there. The Father's Day storm of about 3 years ago was one that comes to mind. We had a whole bunch of roof damage. We had a whole bunch of dock damage. And the authority did a couple of things. Number one, we maintained the integrity of our permitting program by issuing permits. But we also waived a lot of permit fees, particularly for the stuff that happened on land. And that's been a standard practice of ours.
Mac, we've been through this to places where we live. And the intent of that language, I have people laughing over it, but the intent of that language is if you're changing the whole roof, you could decide to go to cardboard shingles.
Correct.
The intent of that process on the permitting is to ensure that the roof that you replace with is still acceptable. For instance, we lived in one addition where the cedar shingles were forgotten, and we had hail damage, and one member in the community decided to put cedar shingles on their house, which is a fire hazard. So, these are the kind of, that's why a permitting process is necessary when you redo the entire roof. Because you can change it to something that is unacceptable.
Right.
Mike, when all this came up, I called the city of Graham and talked to their inspector there and was asking how they determined when you needed a permit. And he made a good point of saying, well, it was basically the difference between cosmetic work and structural work, which kind of made the definition a whole lot more clear than trying to decide is it maintenance or is it modification or whatever. I thought it was a real easy to understand definition, whether it's cosmetic or structural.
That would make sense.
Is this document online? This is the document that y'all worksheets, whatever.
It was. I don't know if we've got that.
That's been made available to the public?
Yes. The comments to the document itself, that went to the city again afterwards. The staff response to those comments were not back online.
I don't believe that was put online. That was just wrong.
Okay.
The other
are they still online?
They're
online. Well, let me ask you another then. Does the public have access somewhere online to what this group has done as far as making these comments? But not right now. Okay. I would make one more comment on that. I think what the public will see when they see that is a lot of thought went into it by the staff, and that a lot of the comments that they made were reacted to and responded to in a reasonable manner. Not having seen that, that was one of the things I thought I was hearing. They still have the question, but I do believe when they see that as much response as the staff has given to this, that you have been responsible in trying to come up with an appropriate document.
When somebody puts in for a permit, do they have to pay the permit fee up front at that time?
There is for things that occur on land, permits, construction permits, there is a, I believe it's a $50 non-refundable upfront fee.
So if the permit was denied, they wouldn't get their money back?
That's correct.
Is that what cities normally do? I mean, is that how a city...
You know, I can't speak for a whole bunch of municipalities. I don't know, Lily, maybe you...
In my experience with a couple cities I've been involved with, generally there's a permit fee initially. Either the contractor or the homeowner will go in and pull a permit. They'll pay the fee, and then they're required to, you know, commence the construction. If at any time during the construction process the inspector finds that it's deficient or doesn't meet the requisites, then the project would be red tagged or frozen, and then the inspector would come out and say, there's a problem with this because of X, whatever the problem is, and then the individual is given time to remediate or to fix, you know, what the issue is, so that they can, the goal in inspection, I think, is always to get the process to where construction's okay at the end of the day. You know, it may take going back and some work between the inspector and either the homeowner or, you know, in the instance of a contractor, talking with them about what the deficiencies are so they can remediate. But normally the fee is paid up front.
And if I could just add to that, the non-refundable aspect of it, from the time you submit that construction request, there's a lot of staff work that goes into this. Quite honestly, that far exceeds the $50 fee. Whether it's approved or whether it's not approved, it requires office time from the office staff, as well as generally we send an inspector out on site to take a look at it. In most instances, we don't end up denying construction applications. What ends up happening is, as a result of our inspector showing up on site, we work with the leaseholder to make that construction application possible. So it's not very often, and I'm not sure that I can even, well, I imagine it's happened, but it's not very often that we actually, you know, just tell them no and go home and see you later.
Have you looked at implementing all these new rules, the inspections and various things that you recommend doing? How much increase in the expenses out of your office is this going to
Obviously, code compliance is an area that we have not jumped into, and we considered that. The staff considered it when they developed this guide. We consulted with several different municipalities how they handled those compliance issues, and we received some information, for instance, from the city of Hillsboro. That said, the way they handle it is they contract out that aspect. They have an engineering company on, I guess, a retainer or some type of document, and it's a cost pass-through to the individual doing the major construction. So in terms of additional costs, as far as that contract is concerned, yeah, there would be some minor administrative costs to administer the contract. But in terms of actually paying for those inspections, that would be a pass-through to the person doing construction. In terms of other areas, quite honestly, our inspectors every organization can say this, but they're overtasked and undermanned. We've got two inspectors up there right now, and we do well just to keep up with our transfer inspections, which are important for the leasees when they want to transfer their property. We need to make sure those inspections happen. So it may be that there is a plus up in some of our inspectors, but that's yet to be determined, and that would be something that you as the board would vote on in terms of any budgeting.
So in light of all the requirements for the dock inspections, do you feel like you'll need, these same two inspectors cover that area also, or do you, you're going to think you need more people?
We're probably going to need more people. I think we're probably going to need a couple or more inspectors. And just up front.
Well, I think there needs to be a discussion of increased staff in light of all the rules. I mean, I don't think you can just ignore the fact of the increase in expenses. So that needs to be discussed at some point, I think.
Okay.
One other question. Where did you get all the building codes and things like that that are recommended in the documents?
They were generally recommended codes adopted by most municipalities. I mean, we tried not to put anything in there that was not applicable.
But like, did you check with Fram and Mineral Wells, or did you look at Metropolitan City?
Again, we took a look at a little bit at the city of Hillsboro. We talked to some folks from Mineral Wells. We talked to some inspectors from Mineral Wells. We contacted inspector up in Grant. We think we've got reasonable codes quoted in there. I don't think we have anything that is in electrical code, the building code, and then some codes for marinas and fuel dispensing and things like that.
If I may, Tiffany, not to put you on the spot, I think you did some homework in that area, didn't you?
My homework was mainly in regards to marinas, and that is, one, those are the codes that is recommended for all marinas at the Corps of Engineers Lakes. We also discussed our codes with the Hood County Fire Marshal. We're going to have some discussions with me as far as making recommendations on the electric code and the marina codes and some of the uniform building codes. They would require marinas at a core lake, or that the Hood County Fire Marshal would like to see to provide adequate fire protection for that large amount of private property that those marina owners are interested in storing.
Tiffany Morgan is our Upper Basin environmental planner. Just so. Thanks, Tiffany.
Yeah, and my thought on it is it's kind of divided into two sections, because on-water facilities are our responsibility. I mean, it's within our FERC license. It's on the lake. It's something that, whether we collect a fee for it or not, it is our responsibility to make sure that those facilities are maintained and maintained to the highest standards. In regards to off-water facilities, homes, you know, I think what I hear Mark saying is, I don't want to get in over our head, and I don't want to be, and I'm using these terms very lightly, I don't want to be inspecting the changing of light bulbs. But on the flip side of that, I want to ensure that, and, you know, the infamous Staubach survey, from what I saw from some of the responses on that, people indicated that it was important to them that they knew, and that their neighbors were doing things correctly. From a personal standpoint, if I was to build a nice new home and my neighbor was to build a nice new home, I'd like to at least know that he went through the same proper procedures that I did, and that it offered some sort of security. I mean, well, we know that the fire situation on the peninsula is not good. It concerns me that there is no fire protection up there. So, you know, I think we need to break it into two separate issues, and I'd really like everybody to chime in a little more and give me some feedback, and let's try to keep those two separate, because I think they are two very separate issues.
Director Deere, we did talk internally at length about this as well, both on water and on land, and that. And as we got the input from Staubach and saw their position and their view as well, we felt like it was justifiable that we leave it in and probably needed to.
The other thing I wanted to mention is we were brought into litigation over an issue on the west side of the lake. I'll build you. Bottom line is, an inspector went out, had a construction request to put a house up. They took a look at the house, and again, our inspectors are not code compliance inspectors. We took a look at where the house was placed in relation to the FERC project area and some other issues, but mainly on placement of the facility, and we approved it. Okay, and there was a power line that was either there or constructed shortly thereafter that ran over that facility that did not meet code. And as a result of that, a workman on top of a building was electrocuted, and we were subsequently brought into litigation regarding any liability associated with that workman's injury. Had there been an inspector out there that had taken a look at that facility in relation to that high wire line, high tension wire, we probably would have avoided that issue, and the individual who unfortunately lost an arm in the process perhaps would not have been there. And again, it goes back to if there's a code there that says you got to have a wire that's 20 foot above the top of the house, if you don't have an inspector that is aware of those codes, you're not going to know.
Okay. Yes, sir. I have a leased house in College Station. I had it damaged 2 years ago. I had to get a permit from the city of College Station in order to put a roof on my house. So I don't see any difference, at least property or own property, whatever. If you're putting a roof on a house, it's a structural problem, so I think a permit should be required. I mean, if I had to pay a permit on a leased property on a house in the city, I mean, that's just protecting yourself, you know, making sure that the materials are meet standard, meet code, everything else, and it's inspected and meets quality. It's protecting yourself in the long run, because you don't know what the contractor could put, be putting cheap, defective material up there without being inspected.
I'd like to ask Mike, getting back to the comments that Martha and Wade made, I think you make a good point about staff. Wade's point about a consistent application of whatever the codes are going to finally be up there is, I think, most important. Taking the example from Wade of the house built back next to the other house, I think that those things need to be consistently and even-handedly applied. And I don't think we can do it if we're understaffed. And that's, I think, it's a very important point that you bring up. It's not staffing up, I think, to meet the small, minor, the light bulb, if you will. But it is adequate staffing, the trained staff, so that the folks up there, when they have an inspection, have an inspection that's even and consistent throughout that lake. I don't think you could have, the process without that.
Is there any possibility of using contract staffing from one of the cities?
Yes. Our intent, let me be real clear about this. We are going to continue to do those types of VRA inspections that we have to do in order to ensure protection of our FERC license. And those are with our internal inspectors. Okay, code compliance inspections we fully anticipate to contract out for. There's a couple, and that's really very common. I think the City of Mineral Wells does it. Hillsborough does, we know, because we contacted the folks and chatted with them. It is not an unusual situation to do that. But I think it's important to note that whether or not you adopt codes or not, the requirement for additional inspectors is probably going to remain because, like I said, with the proliferation of activities on that lawn and around that lake, we just can't keep up with our existing staff.
Did you cover in your in the manual here the cost, the $50 application fee is non-refundable, fine, that makes sense, that the inspection fee must be paid for by whoever it is that needs it, and not paid for by the authority on our ticket?
I believe so. I'm going to
bring it up to
3 points. I think,
hey, it's... The $50 covers all the inspection. No. Good.
Paragraph 3.3 in volume 1K.
I almost said 3.
Read it.
Specifically under item D, there we are, and it says ongoing work is inspected by a licensed inspector contracted by the authority at the lessee's expense who certifies that structures meet all codes, national, state, and local, that apply to their leased property.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, that covers the National Electric Code, Southern Home Builders Code, and everything else.
Southern Building Code.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I do. This is kind of changing the subject, but one thing I felt that needed to be added to this book is deals with the appeals. And there's no formal rules of procedure or anything set up according to what I read, you know, in the questions and all. If someone had an appeal, this is a new document, and there probably are going to be some gray area. If we had just listed in there rules of procedure, if anyone had an issue with this document, it could be anything as simple as, you know, go to the project manager, next go to the regional manager, finally go to our general manager, and then I don't know if you want to carry it farther than that, but there's going to be changes of staff. If we just had a paragraph in there, if they did have a dispute, then they would know procedures of what to do. It's not in there now, and we'd probably have to reinvent it each time. It would be very clear if you just put some wording in there that said, you know, this is what you could follow. We don't want any litigation on either side, and if we had something like that.
And we certainly think, I think we certainly agree. I mean, part of the point of this whole thing is to communicate clearly what the requirements are at the Possum Kingdom and the lessees so they know 99% of everybody wants to do things right. Now, once you know it, you're going to do it right. But on those occasions where there does become an issue, we feel strongly that it can be handled through that that appeals process that you just mentioned. Hopefully that will clear your docket, the board's docket, perhaps more salient issues that are
right.
That you guys have to deal with.
So is that specified in there? Like if I had a question and I were a customer, would I know that that was the procedure?
Well,
I think we need to put it in. We need to be very specific. It was addressed. It was one of the comments we had. I don't know if y'all can pull it up. It's comment 16. On the comment board. But let me read to you. There was a comment made. It said, but perhaps the most troubling thing is that nowhere is there any provision for appealing or disputing BLA decisions or actions in cases where interpretation of these regulations falls into a gray area. Staff's response was, staff disagrees. While no formal appeals process is contained in this guide, in practice, the staff believes an aggrieved individual can appeal for reconsideration of the project manager, upper basin manager, and ultimately the general manager. I don't think there's a problem with writing that in. What you just described.
I read that, but I feel like it needs to be specified in there.
And I think we can add that to the book for clarification so there's no question. Because the concept was always that we would do that. I mean, it's certainly, and you know, no disrespect to anyone, it's not Mike's decision. It would start with Mike. If that doesn't work out, then it would go to, you know, to the upper base, and if that doesn't work, then it would go to general manager.
Well, would the language not be appropriate in this particular case that if a dispute arises on such a technical matter that the licensing documents have issued some type of arbitration among professionals that know what it is they're doing instead of coming up to us up here, then I might not understand the difference between A, B, C type moves. I think it might be something appropriate to write into this process that in case of dispute or a disagreement about a permit, that it go to an arbitration thing, and that arbitration be perhaps in that instance, the cost of arbitration may be shared by both parties, being the appellant and the board representative.
Well, we can if the board is desirous of
that's
that,
right.
We can put
it. Doesn't come here. It goes to parallel professionals.
We discussed that from a staff perspective, Director Bayline. Part of the reason why we avoided it, frankly, was we were just concerned about the ultimate cost of arbitration becoming probably more burdensome than what the cost of repair would be. So, I guess our contemplation was that if we had the appellate process where you had to go through, you know, three tiers of management, that would be. You know, that would be sufficient. But if the board is desirous, we could, you know, we could certainly put that in. But that's why we didn't include it.
That would be able to be the process in the city that has a community where those things are heard rather than by the full city council in this particular case. I'm arguing about the fact that I don't want to be the city councilman for Possum Kingdom or any place else. And those matters usually never get the city council because they're arbitrated out by the Public Works Committee or some type of appointed board. In this particular case, the fact that there's an appeal might have to be handled by professionals rather than by us. Of course, there will be a further appeal after that if that's the case. But it first should be heard by someone who knows the business of construction, certain building code or electrical code or whatever the case may be.
Okay.
I would like to avoid that arbitration process if possible. It seems to me if you go through three layers of management and we end up with a general manager, that should be the final step.
Yeah, we've said that before.
I mean, that seems like it's overkill even, but at least that's enough. And when you start talking about arbitration, now you're going to add costs on top of that. It just seems like that's more than we need to do.
And also, there might be some things in our statutes and all that we're not willing to arbitrate, and I would hate to bind us to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, be quite honest, we felt that the level of management responsibility that would go through to the general manager effectively would be that. And once he made a decision, the board would support that, and it wouldn't be brought in the board. That was kind of our position on it.
But I'm just trying to, my point, and I don't want to be argumentative about this, but the fact is that most of the time in a disagreement, the complaint is actually about the staff decision. It's actually a complaint about staff deciding this or that or the other. In this particular case, we talked about bringing in an outside inspector, but the man is actually working as an adjunct staff member, and I have suggested before here that the end of these things ought to be the general manager instead of coming to us, the board. I've been arguing about this from the very time. I don't want to sit here arguing about a blue roof or a pink roof or anything else. That's not my role here. We're supposed to be making policy, not making decisions about technical things.
Well, and let me just add something. In regards to the three pieces of the puzzle that we're putting together, which is the boat loading study, the shoreline management, and install back. I mean, we all need to be real clear that the decisions that we're going to make in the next 2 months are decisions that not only we're going to live by, but that future boards can live by. And the only way that that's going to happen is, I think the process of going through Mike and then Kent and then Phil is a good process. I think they have the ability to be objective, and I think they have the ability to work within these guideline books. What we need to avoid is we need to avoid that when those three processes don't work and individuals come to the board, that we support the documents that we've agreed to support. Because the first time we go and we deviate from what we've agreed to move forward, it opens the door for more deviation. And that's why we are where we are today. We can't be bending the rules that we make, because the minute we bend them, we might as well just break them. So that's why we're holding off on making decisions today, and we're having this meeting and then another workshop. So I was going to kind of save some of these comments for the end of the day, but I want to make sure that when we all leave here today, that we don't put our books on the shelf for the next month and let them collect dust, that we really read through them and understand the decisions that we're making, because you know, they do have implications. Like Martha said, they've got financial implications for us. They have timing issue implications. And so this is the foundation that we need to lay. And if we lay a good foundation, then we'll have a good structure. But if we lay a foundation that's rock with questions and outs, then we're just setting up, you know, not only for ourselves but future boards additional problems that I've heard complained about since I've been here, and that's been 2 years. So I really want the communication and the discussion on this to continue, because this is pretty critical here.
On the arbitration question, there's nothing that would, if it's not written in here, there's nothing that would prevent going to arbitration, and that's more or less triggered by legal action.
Yes, ma'am. I think you're correct, and I think if we ran into a situation where an issue came before the general manager and he felt like it was a difficult issue that wasn't directly addressed, maybe there was some ambiguity, it could be appropriate to go arbitration or mediation. Frankly, if I were choosing between binding arbitration and mediation, I think most people personally come out of mediation happier, because they have an opportunity to sit down. Generally, neither side comes out completely happy, but it's more participatory. If you go into binding arbitration, oftentimes both sides end up miserable, and arbitrators, quite frankly, they sort of apply a Solomon approach. I mean, they sort of split things right down the middle, and generally neither side is real happy. So, I mean, I think if you go through, my recommendation is if you go through the three processes, and like you're suggesting, Director Kilgore, in the event that Phil reaches a situation where he feels like it's a big enough issue, maybe there's an ambiguity in the policy, or he's got a real question about this particular case, we could certainly go into a mediation. It would be a lot less costly than what it would be to go through the arbitration process. But either one would certainly be open.
Another question. Mark, can you speak to the pre-existing structures, the new wording, in regards to the FERC project area? I'm not a real FERC expert. Because it talks about the structures in place before 89 and the ones after. I don't really think I understand all that.
Correct. There was a small watch, which got to understand the whole picture. In 89, there was a concern that FERC had established a project area, and through the course of time at Possum Kingdom, structures had been constructed inside that project area that were violative of our FERC license. The best, and this is as I understand it, okay, the authority went before FERC and said we need to have some relief from this for the structures that pre-exist. And what came out of that is actually a thing called the Brazos Rule that affected all FERC licenses across the country. And what it allowed us to do is it allowed us, number one, to leave to leave all of those pre-existing structures alone where they sat, and in fact, those structures could be reconstructed provided they did not extend beyond that existing footprint. Okay. Also, the Brazos Rule allowed us to give the authority, or the project manager, the authority to authorize certain structures within the FERC boundary, and those included docks, piers, and walkways, landscape plantings, and erosion control methods. That language was carried forward in our relicensing effort, and pretty much that's the way it is today.
So the sentence where it says any structures erected in the FERC area after 89 may be required to be removed, what are you, anything? I'm not sure exactly what that means.
For instance, we've got a couple going on right now today. What happens generally is they're not homes. They'll end up being patios. There'll be fire pits. There'll be those kinds of activities, generally unpermitted, that get constructed inside that FERC project area. And quite honestly, if it's violative of the FERC project area, there's little that I can do other than have it removed. And we're doing that on a couple of instances. I think we've probably done it 3, 4, 5 times within the last 3 or 4 months.
Mike, let me ask a question. Part of my recollection of that discussion when we adopted that sentence was to give us some flexibility so that when we go through a FERC inspection, if we have a FERC inspector who points out a particular issue, even though it's been there maybe sometime after 89, if FERC raises the issue, then we would not have a choice but to take some action. I think at the end of the day, there's probably stuff in the FERC boundary that's been there for a while, and to some extent, I think the authority needs a little bit of discretion in that. I don't think we want to immediately go out and eradicate everything, because we recognize the fact that over the years the authority has let people put things there.
Yeah, and so absolutely.
The concept is we don't want to go out and say if there's something in the FERC project area that was built after 89, that's the cutoff and everything else has to be removed. Our thought was we needed to apply some sort of principles of common sense. If it's already there, it's there before our time, to the extent we can leave it there, I think what staff discussed is then let's leave it there. However, if it's problematic, if it's going to become very specifically violative of FERC, if the FERC inspector comes down and says, hey, that's problematic, we don't have a choice. We are bound by what FERC says. So the language, the reason it's like that was, and the may instead of shall was to provide us some flexibility in allowing folks who've had things out there for a while, who did it with a lot of people, I think, in good faith, felt like it was okay, or they didn't know, or there wasn't any enforcement. So for us to go out now and rigorously enforce, I think we thought that would be unreasonable.
How do you make the determination of what was there before 89 and after? Just
what we do, and we do diligence on this really almost on a daily basis there, is my instructions to the inspectors are go out and take a look at the file number one to see what the construction applications exist in the file. If it's in the file and it was approved, we leave it alone. Then we take the next step and we do a little bit of common sense diligence. If there's a reasonable method by which you can determine whether or not that was pre or post 1989, we'll use that criteria. And it, in lieu of not having that, we'll look at the at whatever it is that is offending the license and make a determination based on just how old it looks. If it looks like it was probably there before 89, we leave it alone. And we're more often than not apt to err on the side of leave alone. But there are some instances, for instance, there's some instances over at the ranch that have occurred. And we've just told them to bring it out because it was obvious the fact that the ranch didn't develop until 97 or later. And that's happened. And it has happened at other places around the lake as well.
Anybody have anything else?
Another question on the pilot program regarding the permits and decals and whatnot, and there were several comments made about that situation. Can you just kind of explain to me the requirement for the decals and the fact that the lessee, this person who signed the lease, is the only one who can acquire a decal, that sort of situation?
Sure. Well, as y'all are familiar, y'all approved a boat loading, or excuse me, boat loading. Y'all approved a water recreational user fee program, and in the process of approving that, y'all were very specific with us that you listened to the CAP, number one, who made a case that says leaseholders and dock owners ought to be exempt from this. You listened to them, and you also added an element for active duty and retired military personnel and people over 65 that they'd be given a break on the prices. So that's exactly what we've done. It's exactly what you told us to do. What that means is that if you're on the dock out there, if you are the permit holder on a dock, or if you are the leaseholder, a signatory to a lease on the property, and you have five boats in your name, we give you five stickers. That's how we're operating our pilot program right now. To date, we have issued in excess of $50,000 of free stickers to leaseholders and to dock owners. And through the first 3 months of the program, which are our slow months of the year, January, February, March, we've received revenues in excess of about $22,000 with the busy part of the season yet to go. So the pilot program is proceeding as we anticipated, my thought would be, and of course it would be up to y'all, that a pilot program ought to probably run for at least a year, maybe two, and then we evaluate it, take a look, see if there are changes that need to be made, and then make those changes.
Two questions on that. For the VRNSE to get their decals, the only option for them is to go to the office, correct? There's not a way for you to mail?
Well, not really. We have the staff opened up offices both on the west side and the east side during the fall of this last year. We advertised those dates in the newspaper, on the website, and everything else that we could to make it convenient for our leaseholders and for our dock owners to come over there on a Saturday and pick up their free stickers. In lieu of receiving them there, then the only place that the free stickers are offered is at the during normal duty hours at the lake office.
And am I correct? If you don't get a sticker and, like, somebody gets stopped on the lake and they don't want to pay for a permit, the fine is $500?
It's not $500. I think it's a Class C misdemeanor, and that's a $200 fine. It's like a citation on the water if you didn't have your life vest on.
Okay, because I was curious as to how the amount of the fine was, how you came up with that.
And we have been, yeah, we don't come up with fine. And quite honestly, we're not interested in fining a lot of people. I mean, say again? We're a different money.
Right.
I mean, we would much rather see the person go ahead and say, okay, I need to go get my $5 daily sticker or whatever type of sticker they want to get, rather than go see Judge Grisham and pay a $200 fine to the county and Texas Parks and Wildlife.
So the county and Texas Parks and Wildlife are the ones that get the fine?
Like all of our citations. That's where the money is divided between. So, and we're, you know, our rangers are very sensitized right now to the fact that this is a new program. We want to give everybody the opportunity to comply with it. We know that most people want to do the right thing, and so we're approaching it from that perspective.
If there's somebody's boat sitting on their dock and they're from Lubbock and haven't had a chance to go get their decal, they're not ticketing boats that are sitting there. They're ticketing or approaching boats that are actively on the water. Is that right?
Technically, if they're on the water, they should have a sticker.
In the water.
In the water. If they're not in the water, then it doesn't apply. Right now, what our anticipation is that we'll enforce this through normal routine water safety checks, which obviously occur on the water while the boat's in operation.
Don't say that.
Anybody else have anything on the shoreline management guide? Carolyn?
Well, I think I've heard a couple things today. I think, Phil, for the next May meeting, if we could have somewhat of an understanding in regards to additional staffing, additional costs that we'll be faced with in regards to the permitting process. If we could go ahead and we could add to the book the three steps of...
we could add a grievance procedure.
Yeah, grievance.
And it may just be me. I'm not so sure I'm real clear on the dividing line between permitted, and I'm talking off-water facilities, permit needed versus permit not needed. And I don't know if we can get down to a definite line in the proverbial sand, but I want to make sure that we are as clear as possible so that it's easy for these folks to understand and it's easy for us to live with what we've done.
Mike, a couple of places we've lived, the dividing line there has been something like if it changes the appearance, i.e. you go from nice brown roof to a bright red one when you change the whole roof. You're going to change the color of the house when you paint it. You know, there's a beautiful house sitting here and you say you're going to paint it pink and black. These are the kind of things that we've faced when it is a major re-cosmetic look of a house.
So if you're saying if you want to just paint your house, you have to have a construction permit?
No.
If you wanted to change the color.
I think we're...
That was actually the places we've lived, so...
Was that, like, in an area where...
Lago Vista, not also live in an area like that.
But was that an area where all the homes were kind of structural integrity?
No, it was not.
It's kind of a distinguishing thing. She had a static versus structural, I think.
Well, there's a couple of things. I think Mike mentioned it a few times about footprint. I mean, that's pretty obvious. Whether it be a barbecue pit or whatever that extends the boundaries of the house, then there are major repairs, and none of the ones that are that in between. But I think a simple phone call to Mike might put up a lot of that.
Well, and it got them to follow up with Sal saying, you know, how easy is it for people to get a clear answer? I mean, that as opposed to trying to go through minutia of regulations and types and examples, how easy would it be for someone out there to call and how available are those people to answer those questions? Because, I think we have to be sensitive to that. You're asking the owner of the store, okay? But I'm going to tell you that Ken Hyde is sitting over there. The two inspectors work for him, and he fields phone calls on a daily basis, and we're happy to do it. And we tell the customers calling in, we're happy to do it, but we would much rather see the situation handled up front rather than us having to go out and get involved in it, and then it costs the leaseholder money, and we don't want that, they don't want that, and I think we're very, very available to them.
You had to document it. And what was said and what was agreed to is documented?
Oh, yes. A lot of times it happens, just quite honestly, they'll call in and say, well, you know, I'd kind of like to put a, you know, I want a patio kind of here and it's over there or whatever, and we'll give them the basics of it, but the end of that conversation always goes, what you really need to do is you need to put this down in writing, either on a construction application or on a dock application or whatever it is, you bring it in, and then if we have any further questions, we'll ask you, and if we sign up to it, we'll hold our own to it. But your question, Mr. Penny, was whether or not we're available to them, and I think the answer to that is yes. Kay's on the phone daily, as is Joni up front, and these folks know these people. Up at Possum Kingdom and try our best to work with those folks up front. The problems normally come in after the fact. Somebody says, well, you know, I put in a $25,000 sidewalk and we see it on the lake. What can you do to help me make it legal? Well, we'll work with you, and even in those instances where it probably shouldn't happen in the first place. We'll work with them to try to do the best we can, but unfortunately there's some circumstances that say, hey, you know, built it right in the foot project area, and the license says you can't do that. You got to pull it out.
Does anybody have anything else?
Just a comment. This is a first step to having something that's consistent. Rules that are there that people can read those rules. And we're trying to make them as clear as possible, but it's the right way to go. I mean, we have had so many people come to the board with questions of the colors of an elevator and things that don't need to come here. And I agree with Director Bayon that we don't need to hear that kind of stuff, and this is the way we're going to fix that problem. So I think whatever time we need to take to fix it, we need to do it, and we need to hear it all. And I have to commend the staff on what they have done in response to all of these comments, because in most cases, there was something clearly that we need to fix. You fixed it. So I really appreciate what you've done and hope that the folks at PK can understand that we are working hard to try to make something they can live with and we can live with, and everybody will know up front what they need to do. What's appropriate.
Well, I'd like to reiterate that. I mean, I know how much time the staff's put in on this deal, and it's been a lot. But I'd also like to commend those people from the community that took the time to go onto our website and to print the document and to go through it and to make some very good comments. I was a little disappointed that we didn't have more people do it, but the comments that we received were very good. It helped us out. And, you know, we talk about communication all the time, and I think that was a positive step on both sides of the fence to communicate. So I want to thank those people.
I can understand why we didn't do this before today, but okay, now we're through this document probably for today. Are we going to have that online before the May?
Yeah, can we get the updates made and get it back out? Done. Okay. So it'll be back online.
And there were 55 changes that you made from the comments.
A lot.
It was pretty substantial. Over 55 comments that resulted in changes. And there's a lot. Many of them that were on the same subject.
Yes, ma'am. And there's a lot we didn't address. For example, there was a lot of minor things. One thing, for example, in the permitting process, we had a comment that the time frame is too short. It was 30 days. We changed it to 60 days. So I agree very much with you and with Director Blum. I think when the folks from PCA have the opportunity to kind of go through and see the changes they made, because they haven't seen it, I think that's going to assist us, because they're going to see that we really tried to go back and address some of the concerns, because they raised some very valid concerns. And I think we made as many changes as we could to try to address those concerns.
And even helped us with our grammar.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, at this time I'd like to take a 10-15 minute break, and then we'll come back and move into the shower. Ice cream.